Hello and welcome back to the KPMG Financial Reporting Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Tricarci, and today we're going to continue our conversation about IPOs. On our last episode, we talked about the outlook for the IPO market this year and what really goes into the process of going public. So if you didn't catch that episode, please go back and give it a listen. Today, we're going to take a deep dive into one of the most critical and often misunderstood parts of going public, which is the Form S-1 that must be filed with the SEC. It really is the backbone of the IPO process, and getting it wrong can mean delays, lots of questions from the SEC, and even missing that infamous IPO window. And there is nobody better to break it all down than my guest today, Melissa Rocha. Melissa recently joined KPMG after spending 24 years at the SEC, where she most recently served as the acting chief accountant of the Division of Corporation Finance. So she knows this S-1 inside and out. And today she's going to share the 24 years worth of insights and best practices for communicating with the SEC, which honestly is often a missed opportunity for companies. And I even asked her about a few IPO horror stories. So hope you guys enjoy. Melissa Rocha, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Melissa, I gave a brief introduction of who you are in the cold open, but I don't think I really even came close to doing it justice. So can I just ask you to share some of your background from your time at the SEC?
Yeah, so I started my career at KPMG out of college and then went over to the SEC in 2000. So I'd been there 24 years and actually grew up in the Division of Corporation Finance, where I got to be a part of the review program in probably five different industry offices, which I'll probably explain at some point during this podcast on how they're organized. And then the last 4 years was actually serving as the deputy chief accountant in Corporation Finance's Office of Chief Accountant. And so just rejoined KPMG at the end of April. So I'm happy to be here and I'm happy to participate in your podcast, Nick.
Yeah, we are extremely happy to have you at KPMG. And I am personally very happy to have you on this podcast because you're the perfect person for this topic, I think. You know, last month I had Sherry Major on and we talked about, you know, what does the IPO market look like and where does she expect things to go? And then we talked about steps that companies need to take when they're preparing to go public. And we barely dipped our toes in the water about like the SEC and regulatory part of all that. But now with you, I want to take a deeper dive into that process and the Form S-1 itself and take all of your great 24 years of experience and share it with our audience and give them some tips and tricks for, you know, when they're going through this process on their own. So I like to level set things, Melissa. So my first question is just, can you explain big picture what the S-1 is?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I mean, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm thinking, wow, I must have probably reviewed thousands of those S1s.
I was going to ask you how many you've reviewed. Yeah.
I'd have to go back and guess on that one. But yeah, sure. So an S-1 is the SEC's registration form for a private company that they would file when they want to start selling shares to the public for the first time. And so that document lays out the company's history, their financials, risks, and how it plans to actually use the money that it raises. And then once the SEC reviews and declares it effective, the company is then, you know, becomes a reporting company and can then complete the process for trading. And I've actually heard multiple people refer to the S-1 as a book, and it has two, you know, big chapters or parts, if you will. And so part one is referred to as the prospectus. And that describes the company's intentions, strategies, their financial health, and gives a glimpse into the company itself, where investors should be able to assess the risks and the rewards of investing in that company. And then the second part of that contains all the technical and legal details that the SEC would need. So such as an exhibit, exhibits, the officer and director biographies, legal opinions, the auditor's consent, and all the signature pages.
Yeah. So the SEC is like, look, if you want to raise money from the public, you know, by selling your shares, you've got to fill out this form. But to your point, it's more like a book, not really like a form that you think of filling out online, so people can understand what they're putting their money into.
Correct. Yeah. Not a check the box or check the a checklist.
So before we get into the technical nitty gritty of what goes into the Form S-1, I wanted to start this conversation by talking about the process a company goes through to file the form with the SEC and then communicate with the SEC staff, because you know this better than anybody, but this can really make or break a company's IPO timeline. And I really want to get your take on this, because I personally feel like a lot of companies miss opportunities to be proactive when they're engaging with the staff, which, you know, can make the process go a lot smoother, potentially faster. And I'm thinking it's either because they don't realize they can, or maybe they don't realize how the process works. So can you just start by giving us a 30,000 foot overview of how this filing process works? And then I want to pick your brain on best practices for communicating with the SEC.
Sure. And so when the S-1 is filed, it will get routed to an industry group. And then that industry group will then assign the review, since all IPOs are, you know, receive a review. And it will then be assigned a review team. And that for an S-1 is typically assigned to both an accounting team and a legal team. There's a, you know, a legal examiner and a legal reviewer, an accounting examiner and accounting reviewer. And so, and then they just start the review process. And so that could take anywhere from, you know, several months to a year or so, depending. But we can, you know, dig into timing later.
Yeah. And I think a reason why it can take so long is because of the comment letter process, which obviously is what everyone always wants to hear about. You know, I think we do webcasts on it like at least twice a year. So before we kind of dive into those comments specifically, I wanted to ask, in your experience, like, how long does it take for the staff, that review team, to do the initial review? And then how many rounds of comments are common, and how long do each of those take to resolve?
Well, good question. So I can say with certainty that the review teams generally send out first round comments within 30 days of filing. It's the subsequent rounds of comments on amendments that really depend on the complexity of the issues and the volume of comments that you received in the first round. So some comments may need to be referred to other divisions or offices. So for example, after a few rounds of comments, if there's still, you know, some sort of disconnect or you know, disagreement, if you will, on an accounting issue, that issue may be referred to Court Finn's Office of Chief Accountant. Or, you know, if it continues and we need to pull in additional accounting resources, they would refer it up to the agency's Office of Chief Accountant.
Yeah, that's great. There's a lot there, Melissa, that I want to unpack. But I'm glad you brought up this point about, you know, getting other divisions and offices involved, because when I tell people that I worked at the SEC, like, a lot of people just assumed I was reviewing filings and writing comment letters. Kind of like when you say you're an accountant and people just automatically assume you do taxes.
Yeah, that is so funny. And it's so true. So people think you reviewed filing reviews in Court Finn. But when I said I was the acting chief accountant, I always got asked if I was like the new Paul Munter, which is not the case. So just to clarify, yes, there are actually four chief accountants in the agency. So, you know, there is an Office of Chief Accountant in Court Finn, and that chief accountant is considered the accounting advisor to the division director. And then there's the agency's Office of Chief Accountant, where the chief accountant, who is newly announced as Kurt Hull, is the accounting advisor to the chair. So the offices have different functions. All four of them have different functions, but nonetheless, they do tend to work together, which is quite nice.
Yeah. And I mean, I can personally attest that there's a lot of coordination between the groups and the offices of the chief accountants in particular. So anyway, I want to come back to your comment that you made about the number of comments and how that depends in part on, you know, how well the company communicates with the staff. And this is really where I want to pick your brain for some tips, tricks, best practices, whatever you want to call it, for communicating with the staff so that, you know, companies can have a bit of a smoother review process. So how would you advise somebody listening to this as how they should approach that communication?
That's a great question. So I think there is an underlying hesitation to pick up the phone and call the staff, but it is truly an effective way to streamline the process. I'm not saying pick up the phone and call them every single day, but if you have questions on, they should never know your, you know, by your first name, right? But if you have questions on the comments that were issued, I think it is really important. You know, there is contact information for each reviewer on the comment letter. And you can pick up the phone and call them with questions. So with that said, though, you know, oftentimes companies will call and hopes to vet an answer before they put it in their response letter. And I will tell you, the staff will not do that. I mean, they might listen, or they'll certainly answer questions related to the specific comment, but they will not give any assurance that your response that you plan to, you know, put in your response letter is accurate or objectionable. But they'd be able to assist on what they're specifically looking for in that comment. And then, you know, the other thing too is when you've gone through a few rounds, there may also be a time to pick up the phone and request a call with the review team.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. And, you know, I think my takeaway there is it's okay to pick up the phone and call them. And in fact, that might be encouraged either on the front end just to give them a heads up on certain things. Or like you said, if you've gone back and forth a few times with these written comments, it might be nice to just get on the phone and talk through it. You know, generally that's a constructive conversation that can help move the process along. So yeah. The other thing, Melissa, that you mentioned that I just wanted to follow up on is timing. You know, you said 30 days roughly for that first comment letter, and then kind of depends after that based on the complexity and whatnot. But I'm sure people are listening and they're aware of the recent workforce reductions that went into effect at the SEC with, you know, some of the deferred resignation program, early retirement, stuff like that. So I got to ask, like, do you anticipate any, you know, impacts of that reduction on this S1 or just registration statement review processes in general? Meaning, like, should companies start budgeting more time for this to get through the review if it has less staff to perform those reviews?
That's a great question. Personally,
sorry if that's a tough question, but
no. I think it's a great question. Personally, my answer is leaning towards no. Like I mentioned, I've been there 24 years. The division is extremely nimble. They've, you know, had to reorganize before if they've chosen to reallocate companies before or staff. So I don't think there's going to be any negative impact to, you know, the effectiveness of the program or the efficiency of the process.
So, all right, let's talk about the comment letters themselves, right? Again, you know, people are always asking, what's the SEC commenting on? And so I guess if we focus on just the S1, you know, given that's our topic for today's conversation, which areas of that S1 tend to draw the most comments from the staff?
I would probably just say off the top of my head, MD&A, non-GAAP, and segments. And they typically tend to be... Yeah, the same ones over and over again. You'll hear it every year at the ICPA conference. Like, those are always three big topic areas. And so I just want to say generally, it's really important. There might be like various people, and Sherry might have touched on this. There might be various people drafting your S1. Like, there might be somebody that's drafting the business section, you know, that's not drafting MD&A, has no involvement in the financial statements. And so I think it's really important that there's consistency in your drafting, and that everything holds together, and that, you know, your equity story, if you will, or just how you portray your company is consistent amongst internal documents and external. So, you know, with all of that being said, the staff will review, you know, not only the S1, but outside of the four corners of the document. And so they will look to see how you portray yourself on your website, and that would then lead to segment comments, right? Or how you discuss the company in MD&A.
Based on your experience, what advice do you have for companies in terms of, like, how can they head off some of these comments, either in these areas or just in general?
Yeah, I mean, well, I had mentioned just consistency amongst disclosures. So I think getting your team who's drafting, like, all on the same page. But I also think just far enough in advance, identifying, you know, what issues you may run into, and which issues should be submitted to the staff ahead of filing the IPO document. And so what do I mean by, you know, submitting to the staff ahead of filing? You know, if there's any sort of novel transaction or just, you know, unique, complex accounting that you have incurred, there might be an opportunity, or there is an opportunity for you to, you know, open dialogue with the staff ahead of time to get their thoughts on how you're accounting, you know, and you've done this firsthand, where if there's a complex accounting issue, companies can just submit what they refer to as a preclearance letter, where, you know, they would submit, you know, their view and how they have thought about it, and maybe any alternative views. And, you know, the OCA staff will take a look at it and object or not object to the accounting. So there's a lot of things to just think about ahead of time. And we can talk, I'm sure we'll talk more about like the waiver process and that kind of stuff, but really taking an inventory of things that would impact your financial statements and the requirements in the S-1 ahead of filing it.
You know, there's always this decision point for a company. It's like, well, do I just submit it with the accounting and see if the staff comments on it? Or do I, you know, pre-clear it and get the answer so that when I submit, I know that that issue has been resolved one way or the other, right? Whether it's object or not. I think what I'm hearing you say is it's best to err on the side of, you know, being proactive, getting that cleared with the office of the chief accountant, if it truly is, you know, highly judgmental or novel or complicated. Because if you wait, and I'd love to get your take on this, but if you wait, you just file it in the S-1 and Court Finn comments on it, you go a couple rounds, it ultimately makes its way to OCA and they object. Well, you could probably kiss your IPO timeline goodbye, right? Or at least it's going to throw a huge wrench in it, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that is the biggest, I mean, at least I've heard on this side in the last 2 months, I mean, I think companies are really hesitant to take the path of pre-clearing ahead of time because they're worried that it will take a lot of time at the forefront, like ahead of filing. But I, to your point, I mean, I would hate to, you know, file it, get your first comment letter in 30 days. You've gone a couple of rounds, you add another month, and then, you know, they, you know, comment on, let's say it's a revenue transaction or revenue stream, and it ends up going to Court Finn's OCA and then the agency's OCA, like you're talking an added couple of months onto that. So I think it's always wise to sort of think of those things ahead of time, because you save, it might take time at the forefront, but you'll save in the review process. And I'll just share that there's a similar process with reporting issues. Like for example, an IPO requiring 305 financial statements, there's a similar process in Court Finn. So if for whatever reason you've acquired a significant acquisition or a significant target and maybe can't get your hands on those financial statements for whatever reason, or think they're not material for whatever reason, the company can submit a waiver request to Court Finn OCA, asking for the staff to waive those financial statements. And they have the delegated authority under Rule 313 of SX to do so. So, you know, again, another process that you can take advantage of to streamline the comment letter process.
Yeah. And the key there is, right, is that you're prepared, you're identifying these issues in advance so that, you know, you can take it to the SEC, either pre-clear or get a waiver. I do want to ask you about 305. So I'm going to come back to my question on the waiver once we get there. But
okay.
I was going to ask you, Melissa, to give me an IPO horror story from your time in Court Finn, you know, obviously without naming any names, but like a situation where the S-1 just went haywire. But I feel like we kind of just talked about that. And I don't know if you have personal experience with, like, you know, somebody didn't pre-clear it and ended up coming back to bite them.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, there's probably a lot of those. And so I don't have one in particular. Because a lot of little things can derail an S-1. But I do, you know, I do remember specifically a company filing an S-1, and at the same time submitted an interpretive request with CFOCA, that's Court Finn OCA, on identifying a predecessor. And the review team actually decided not to review the filing until the interpretive request was addressed, since it could potentially change the historical financial statements in the S-1. And this completely makes sense. So this is another practice point I would share, is that, you know, if you're going to, you know, request the staff to look at a, you know, reporting issue or an accounting issue ahead of time, I would, or at least the ones that are going to Court Finn OCA, I would do that first before you file your document, because in this case, you know, it made sense. The review team just deferred the review until that issue was cleared. And of course, you know, CFOCA in that case objected to their predecessor analysis, and the company had to withdraw their S-1 and go back to get the correct financial statements and have them audited. And so this just hits on the point that had they identified this, you know, and made those judgment calls earlier on, and they could have submitted that interpretive request long before they filed their live S-1.
Yeah, and been proactive with the communication, which we talked about. I mean, because, you know, that company spent a lot of time drafting that S-1 based on, I'll call it, a totally different starting point, right? And then it all had to change when they got the answer. I'll definitely call that a horror story. So hopefully people that are listening can avoid that, you know, when they go through their own S-1. All right, let's turn our attention to the S-1 itself. And, you know, I think we're going to focus really on that part one or prospectus that you mentioned at the top of the episode, because this is where the audited financial statements get included. You know, we've talked about MD&A, also pro formas if those are necessary. And I want to start with the financial statements, because I think it's one of the trickier parts of this whole thing is that, you know, just because you filed your original S-1 and you included, you know, whatever financial statements in that document, it doesn't mean you're done. You know, like we refer to this as staleness, meaning at some point the financial statements become stale and they must be updated. And this can happen during the process of going through the SEC review. So again, just an area for companies to be aware of up front as they're managing their own timeline. And I wanted to just have you explain, you know, some of those key dates, like when do the financial statements become stale?
So, you know, generally the rule, if you look in Article 3 of SX, generally the latest balance sheet must be as of a date that's no more than 134 days. And this is for a non-accelerated filer. So the days are different for an accelerated or large accelerated filer. The days are 129.
Exactly. I want to try to put some actual dates to that, because, you know, again, this is a confusing area. But, you know, you and I, we've talked about our kids a lot, and I don't think I've told you this story, but I thought of it as we were putting the agenda together for this episode. I went to my son's like end of school year showcase recently. You know, they put on like a little play and then you can look at their artwork and all that good stuff. And so my wife and I are walking around the classroom and we see one of his drawings on the wall, and he wrote in big letters, "Fish and visitors stink after 3 days." And my wife and I look at each other like, where the heck did he learn that from, you know? And apparently it was a quote from Benjamin Franklin. And it was part of a project where they were learning about history. But, you know, thinking about it here, it sounds like you're telling me the financial statements start to stink after about 134 days.
That's right. I like that. Actually, we should use that instead of stale. We should use stink.
Yeah, exactly. So I mentioned I get confused by these dates, because I do. And so I wanted to actually, like, again, let's just use a calendar year company for simplicity. But if we do that, like, what are the key dates to watch out for before, you know, financial statements start to stink?
Yes. Okay. So I will say, I'll give a plug that we do have a publication out there. If you just Google like KPMG updating for, you know, registration dates, that there's a really nice 1-2 pager out there that has these dates out there for 2025. But just a high level share for the remaining of this year. We have an update coming up on August 12th that would require June 30s if you're a calendar year and company. And then an update for Q3 would need to happen around November 12th or 14th, again, based on filer status, on how many days you get there. And there are some nuances around Q3 and updating for year end.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that publication, because it is a really nice cheat sheet. And so we can probably throw a link to that in the episode description. But all right, so like if I'm a company and I were to file my S-1, you know, today, calendar year, I'm including, you know, some historical annual periods, and I'm including March 31st, Q1. And if that doesn't go effective by August 12th, I think you said, which it's not going to based on the timeline you gave us, then I need to update those financial statements to include Q2. And my S-1 is not going to get declared effective until I do that. And so the longer this thing drags out, the more likely it is you need to continually provide new financial statements to the staff, you know, Q1, Q2, Q3, potentially year end. You mentioned there were some nuances around Q3. So I'm curious to see what those are.
So I mentioned that the rules, SX rules, required the balance sheet to be no more than 134 days old in an initial registration statement. So, but the third quarter data, and this gets complicated, but the third quarter data is timely through the 45th day after your most recent fiscal year end for all filers. So that's around February 12th, February 14th, and then timely through the 90th day for SRC. So that'd be for a calendar year end, March 31st. But they have, you have to expect to report income from continuing ops before taxes in the year, in the current year. And that, and you have to have reported income from continuing ops before taxes in at least one of the two previous years just completed. So there is sort of a, there is a, you know, a nuance around that Q3, but you have to meet some criteria. And then after those days, after the 45th day or the 90th day is applicable, you would then have audited financial statements for that fiscal year that you just completed. And that must be included in the registration statement after that point.
Got it. Okay. So, I mean, if you're a company and you're filing your S1, I'll call it in that Q4 timeline. Again, this is really good information to be aware of, that you may need to, you know, update that to include your annual audited financial statements before your S1 is going to go effective. Because, you know, if your normal historical audit cycle isn't really aligned with that, you may want to think about accelerating that so you can get that S1 declared effective as soon as possible, you know, especially if the market conditions are right. So, all right, I'm glad you mentioned that. I think one other thing, there's probably more than one other thing, but at least another thing that is related to the financial statements that I think can catch a company by surprise if they're not prepared and can, you know, potentially throw their timeline for a loop, is that in addition to including their own financial statements, a company might also have to include the financial statements of another company in the S1. So walk us through when that dynamic potentially comes into play.
Yeah. So I had mentioned earlier when we talked about things that might save time, I mentioned the 305 waiver process. But, you know, 305s, you know, are the financial statements of an acquired entity. And S1 does require financial statements meeting the requirements of SX, which includes financial information that's required by 305. And then if you're an SRC, it would be under 804, as well as Article 11 pro formas. And so those SX acquisition rules, which were amended in 2020, are applicable when a business acquisition has occurred in the most recent fiscal year or subsequent interim period for which a balance sheet is required under 301, or has occurred and is probable to occur after the date of the most recent balance sheet filed. So the financial statements to be included, is they're based on significance and their calculations in SX to determine significance. So again, you know, I can't stress enough, it's important to identify whether or not this requirement will be triggered ahead of, you know, filing the S1, because you'll need to get those. That would be a comment off, you know, off the bat, if you've had a significant acquisition and you don't have those financial statements in the S1.
Yeah, exactly. And honestly, we can do a whole nother episode. Maybe we will actually on determining whether it's significant, because those rules are also very nuanced and can get really complicated. But again, key takeaway, if you had a major acquisition in the last year or in these interim periods, you may need to include the financial statements of that acquiree in your S1. And so, you know, that might take some time to get those and work with that company and get those prepared. So again, just something to be aware ahead of time. And Melissa, there's also 309, right, that gets talked about, which is like the similar thing. But if you have an equity method investee that's significant, you may need to include those financial statements. That would also apply in an S1, right?
Yep. And then even 314 for a real estate company. And then again, it goes back to the whole point about the waiver. And I can just quickly share a couple of best practices on that too. But, you know, it's identification early on, so that if you, you know, great, if you have those audited financial statements, that's perfect. But if you don't, you might need to, you know, think about asking for a waiver. And so I will just say, and the staff talk about this at the AICPA conference, it seems like every year, about best practices in the waiver process. And so, you know, again, companies would write in to a CORTFIN OCA, you know, providing a background on the transaction and why those financial statements, either you can't get them or they're not meaningful. But I, you know, it's important that that request be comprehensive, and that, you know, you include all of the significance tests, and that those significance tests are in compliance with Article 102W of SX. If not, you know, you're going to get a phone call from the staff, you know, asking for you to, you know, redo those calculations. And then, you know, there is in that process a lot of dialogue back and forth. I mean, it's not uncommon for the staff working on those waivers to pick up the phone and call. And so, you know, again, it's important to have the right people on the phone, and, you know, helping get through that process. But I will share, you know, a hardship waiver is not one that you're going to get. So the letter should be way more than just we can't get it or it's too hard. Yeah, but again, something to think about early on.
Yeah, because I mean, if you get that waiver, I imagine that could be a big win for your timeline and whatnot. So good to take advantage of it, and if you do, be prepared so that you are aware of what the staff's going to require for that. All right, a few more questions, Melissa, and then I'll get you out of here. But one of the things you mentioned when you were going through the 305 stuff was pro formas. I think I heard you use that term. So just quickly hit on what a pro forma is, because that is also something that might take a little extra work. And then, you know, obviously it comes up in the context of a acquisition, but there's other situations in which pro formas might be necessary. So maybe you could just hit on those quickly.
And the purpose of the pro forma is to show or portray a transaction as if it had occurred at the beginning of the year. So you get sort of a full picture of the impact of that transaction on that historical period. Most of the time, you know, we see them when providing acquiree financial statements, but they can be required for a significant disposition, a spinoff, and we may see that the registrant previously was a part of another entity. And so that such presentation would be necessary to reflect those operations as an autonomous entity. Or, you know, Article 11 pro formas could be required for the consummation of other transactions that have occurred or that are probable, for which, you know, any sort of disclosure pro forma financial information would be material to investors. So Article 11 lists out, I think there's like 8 or 9 different, you know, criteria or transactions that would result in the need to consider Article 11.
Got it. Okay. And then my last question, again, is something we talked about earlier, and I feel like we should hit on. It's a little bit more specific. It may not apply in all cases, but when it does, it can be very complicated. So I just wanted to make our listeners aware of that. And that is the determination of this predecessor entity concept, which is what the historical financial statements are really going to be based on. And so, you know, in a normal, I'll call it a normal, if there is such a thing, in an S1, you're just a private operating company, you go public, it's straightforward, right? Like the operating company, just kind of a continuation of them, and you're going to use the same financials you've been preparing for years. But in a lot of these cases, it's more complex than that. And so I wanted you to just maybe explain a couple of situations where that predecessor evaluation can get a little messy, I'll call it.
Yeah, they can be messy, all right. So a predecessor's historical financial statements are important, you know, to an investing decision. And so the, you know, registrant's financial statements and predecessor financial statements together should cover all required financial statement periods. And it would be rare to not have a predecessor. You know, I mean, again, to your point, there are situations where that would make sense, but for the most part, you know, if you're required to have 3 years of financial statements together, predecessor and registrant should cover those 3 years. So to your question about different scenarios, there tend to be some predecessor issues a lot in the 305 space. And so similar to the waiver request process, there is a process with CFOCA where companies can submit a letter, similar to also the OCA process, where you might have a unique reporting question or interpretation, and you have this interpretive request, if you will. And we see this a lot in the predecessor space. So sometimes, both 305s and predecessor will go hand in hand. So you could acquire a significant business or businesses, and it appears that really what is happening is that, the company, the registrant, is succeeding to one of those businesses, and when that happens right there, you have a question of whether or not one of those acquired companies should be the predecessor. Again, another issue to look out for prior to filing the S-1. And in another example, you would see that is possibly in a put together transaction when you have maybe a private equity combining one or more companies to form a larger company that they plan to IPO. And so, one of the considerations in this type of transaction is, identifying the registrant and which company that you're putting together is the predecessor, or maybe you have multiple predecessors. So it is extremely messy. It can be complicated and subjective. And so again, can't stress enough, something to think about ahead of filing the S-1. And there is a process in place if you need to chat with the staff about it.
Yeah. And again, coming full circle, I think this is an area where, other divisions may get involved. Like if there's a complicated predecessor question and you're going to try to pre-clear that with Corp Fin, a lot of times they're going to ask you, well, who's the accounting acquirer? Walk us through the 805 accounting. And that might require a consultation with OCA. And we're actually dealing with one of those right now. And so again, if you're in that situation, again, important to identify ahead of time. So maybe you get the pre-clear with OCA done first, and then go to Corp Fin, because a lot of times Corp Fin will wait for that answer before they weigh in on the reporting question. And so again, just a lot of coordination there on some of the accounting and reporting issues. I think another one, Melissa, that started to come up is like carve out situation. Who's the predecessor? Is it the carved out operations, or is it the entity in which they were carved out from? And that could be a big change in terms of what that S-1 looks like and what those historical financials look like. So a lot of complexity around predecessor. I guess what I would say to the audience is, if you're trying to figure out who the predecessor is, it's best to call, an accounting advisor and have those folks walk you through the latest and greatest thinking, because it changes from time to time. And obviously, I know you're available, Melissa. I'd be available as well. So feel free to reach out to us. And I think with that, Melissa, I'm going to declare this conversation effective and say thank you for coming on and, sharing all of your great insights with our audience. I think we learned a ton.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Many, many thanks to Melissa Rocha for stopping by, fresh off her return to KPMG after 24 years at the SEC. That's impressive. I mean, she's reviewed more S-1s than Netflix has reboots, and she just dropped a ton of insight on how to keep your S-1 from going off the rails. So if you want all of her great war stories, or more importantly, best practices, make sure you check out the full episode. But as always, here are my three key takeaways from our conversation. Number one, the S-1 isn't just a form, it's a full-on process. I mean, honestly, the term form S-1 is a little misleading. It's more like a book. And the S-1 review process can take anywhere from several months to a year, according to Melissa. And the companies that get through it on the quicker end are the ones that identify the key accounting and reporting issues well before the document is ever filed with the SEC. Having that complete picture of potential items that may draw comments from the SEC staff, plus a clear understanding of the financial statement staleness rules in particular, really allow you to control the process and the timeline versus letting it control you. Which leads me to my second takeaway. Make sure you know where the landmines are. Melissa said it best. There are a lot of things that can derail an IPO. We briefly touched on a few of the common items, like when there's a significant acquisition that triggers the need to include the acquiree's financial statements in the document under Rule 305. You want to make sure you know that up front so you have enough time to get those financial statements in order. And likewise, if you have a significant equity method investment under Rule 309. Plus, there's complex predecessor determinations that can really drive the entire S-1. So you want to make sure you get those right. And then, of course, there's always judgmental or complex accounting positions that may ultimately end up on the desk of the Office of the Chief Accountant. And this is where an experienced advisor can really add a ton of value, not only from identifying the issues, but more so being strategic on the best path to resolve them. That can involve things like seeking a waiver from Court Fin for certain items, or potentially pre-clearing an accounting issue up front to save time on the back end. And then my last, but certainly not least, takeaway. Pick up the phone. Seriously. A lot of companies are hesitant to engage directly with the SEC staff, but as Melissa put it, that communication can be a game changer. Whether it's clarifying a comment or scheduling a call after a few rounds of back and forth comment letters, proactive, thoughtful dialogue helps the review process move faster and smoother. Bottom line. Just don't expect the staff to bless your response in advance, by the way. They'll clarify expectations and their comment, but they're not going to pre-approve your answer. I'm Nick Tricarci, and that's the bottom line. If you're working through your own S1 or honestly any other registration statement and you want to avoid missteps that could set your timeline back, please reach out to myself or Melissa. We'd be happy to talk with you, and you can find us on LinkedIn. And as always, make sure to subscribe and leave us a review. And if you haven't already, check out our CPE podcast platform. We've got close to 10 hours of free CPE credits that you can earn just by listening to this podcast. And we've got plenty more coming. Just go to kpmg.com/us/FRV podcast for our most recent episodes. And, you know, let us know what other topics you want to hear in the future. Thanks again for listening, and we will talk to you later.